New hope in the fight against Ebola today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. An experimental Ebola vaccine is tested in Guinea, and the results are good, but...
When you are trying to do science in the midst of an emergency outbreak in a country that's barely done clinical research, there are some challenges, and there were some trade-offs.
Also, an Iranian finds inspiration in the words of Henry David Thoreau.
I still remember how I heard the first sentence from Thoreau on a $1 pocket radio in the year 1982 or 83.
Plus, forget Jaws, there's something else lurking off the coast of Cape Cod.
It's common knowledge that there were large amounts of ordnance dumped off into the waters, into the deep seas.
Those stories are coming up today here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It could be the beginning of the end for Ebola. Scientists say an experimental vaccine tested in West Africa has shown signs of being highly effective in preventing Ebola. That's potentially huge news given how deadly the latest outbreak has been. More than 11,000 people have died from the virus, mostly in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Medical journalist Sherry Fink has been writing about the Ebola vaccine for the New York Times and has been checking in with us throughout the crisis. She spoke with some of the scientists involved in the study, which was done in Guinea.
Teams would go out and vaccinate as soon as they heard that someone was sick. A new patient got sick with Ebola, and they would go out, they would identify the contacts of that patient and the contacts of those contacts, and they would vaccinate those people first. They called it the ring vaccination approach, creating a ring around a sick person. And what they found was that the people who had gotten vaccinated, once they waited about 6 days to let that vaccine work to trigger an immune response, and also for anyone who was already starting to get Ebola to manifest their symptoms, after 6 days, nobody in that group who had gotten the vaccine got sick. They compared that to patients who, people who didn't get the vaccine, about 16 of those patients amongst several thousand who they tested did get sick. So that was the comparison. And everybody got offered a vaccine. This was sort of the trade-off. There was no placebo. That is sometimes a problem in a clinical trial, but
right. They
felt it, there was some resistance to giving people a fake vaccine in this kind of a situation. So everyone was offered the vaccine, but one group got it right away and one group got it after 21 days. And so that was the comparison.
Still, it's pretty amazing. I've read this vaccine is just as safe as the flu shot I usually get. Can you break down in simple terms how this experimental vaccine works?
What I know about it, I can share. In terms of the safety, of course, keep in mind this is not an approved or licensed vaccine yet. So Merck has bought the license to this vaccine after the outbreak started. It was a vaccine that was developed by the Public Health Agency of Canada some years ago. And they are going to go through that process now. And that involves submitting the safety data. So far, so good. It looks pretty good, but there have been some side effects. So they're going to take a good look at that, of course. And the way that it works is that this vaccine, it's not Ebola itself. You know, anyone who survives Ebola, it's really on the strength of your own immune system, recognizing that virus and starting to make an immune response that eventually overcomes it before the virus, you know, kills the person.
Right.
So what they did is that one of the most highly immunogenic, they say, you know, one of the parts of the virus that people's immune system reacts to the most is a protein on its covering. So the scientists many years ago took that protein, combined it in a virus, VSV virus, which is a virus that infects animals, and they used that to create this vaccine.
So if we remember last summer, it just seems so desperate, and everybody wanted a vaccine, and there were a lot of concerns that it was going to take a long time. Is this quick for a vaccine, an experimental one, to have an effect like this, or did it take a long time?
Both. It took way too long. Way too many people died. Everybody agrees with that. Everybody wishes that there had been a vaccine on the shelf you know, one that had been tested more, that that we had the international systems in place to quickly get a study like this going. On the other hand, compared with how long it usually takes to go from a vaccine that's really never been used in humans pretty much to a phase three, they call it, clinical trial. Like, this is beyond the initial safety trials. It's gone through that in the recent months to actually test the effectiveness. This is, everybody says to me, very fast. So there's a consensus that we want to learn from this, the world, the partners, so they call them, you know, World Health Organization, countries, scientists, in order to get this process going, have procedures in place to do it more quickly the next time, even more quickly the next time.
Sherry, I want to ask you a couple of things about the World Health Organization, because they've been involved in the development of this vaccine. But on the other hand, a lot of people have criticized the WHO for its shaky response to Ebola last summer. How does the WHO come out of this crisis reputation-wise?
They had that initial really slow response. They came in for a lot of criticism and have accepted responsibility for not really recognizing the need to react in a more robust way early on. And this outbreak got out of control, and we had a horrific tragedy. On the other hand, they have made a lot of efforts institutionally to do better. Just today, the head of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, the director general, had a press conference kind of summarizing some of the changes afoot to try to make the organization more effective in the future.
Yeah, but
lessons
what
learned.
About, what about just being more responsive sooner if there's another outbreak?
That is one of their goals. And the question is, you can talk all you want about it, but are the procedures in place? Are the mechanisms in place? And it seems like it's going to be a long process. It seems like everyone agrees that the World Health Organization needs to change. There are all sorts of new processes going on within the organization and outside of it to create that change, but it is a slow process. This is a UN bureaucracy. This is really an expression of the world's will, because the WHO is its member countries. That is all of the countries who are UN members. I get the sense, and there seemed to be a little bit of impatience amongst the journalists listening to this press conference this morning, because it's very clear that that whole procedure is at the beginning. But certainly, nobody wants to see this happen again.
You know, there have been so many different strains of Ebola that have broken out since the 1970s. If this vaccine is everything that we're hoping, does that mean we're going to see the end of Ebola?
You made a good point about the strain. So there's different subtypes of Ebola, and this particular vaccine is made against the kind of Ebola that is currently in West Africa, but there are other subtypes. So there are even better vaccines that are being thought of by the scientists. So this is far from the be-all, end-all. It's a very, very good sign. It's something that, for the very first time, there is something looking effective at preventing Ebola. And certainly, everyone I spoke to, you know, scientists and aid workers and, you know, people who are really skeptical human beings who've seen a lot of suffering and failure. And they were all very cheered by this, because they felt like if Ebola does break out somewhere else, if this subtype does, that there will be a tool to go in to quickly try to vaccinate everyone around that sick person and prevent the kind of horrific tragedy that we've seen in West Africa, with thousands of people dying over the last year.
Well, as far as this experimental vaccine goes, some relatively good news for a change on the Ebola front. Medical journalist Sherry Fink has been covering the Ebola crisis for the New York Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The relationship between Iran and the U.S. over the past 30 years or so could be described as cold and distant. Except for the recent nuclear negotiations, the two countries have had little, if any, official direct contact. It's no wonder, then, if Iranians and Americans have developed somewhat unrealistic views of each other. For one Iranian man, literature has helped close that gap. The World's Shirin Jafari explains.
To me, this is the sound of a perfect summer day. Tiny ripples of cool, refreshing water slapping against my body as I swim in Walden Pond, not far from where I live. Yep, that Walden Pond, the one Henry David Thoreau wrote about in the 19th century.
When I wrote the following pages, or rather the bulk of them, I lived alone, in the woods, a mile from any neighbor.
Thoreau was a man of nature. Like he says here in the opening of his book, Walden, he loved to escape the hustle and bustle of the city and retreat to a quiet corner in the woods. And for years, one man has been following Thoreau's footsteps. Not in the beautiful New England woods where I'm swimming. Actually, thousands of miles away from a small apartment in the polluted air of Tehran.
I feel great to be here for the first time in body. I've been here with you through Walden and Emily Dickinson for a long time in spirit.
Alireza Takhtare is a physician by day, translator by hobby. He just finished the very first translation of Thoreau's Walden into Farsi. And a couple of weeks ago, he set foot in the U.S. for the very first time. He was invited to speak at the Walden Woods Project, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary.
I still remember how I heard the first sentence from Thoreau on a $1 pocket radio in the year 1982 or 83. It said, "The man who goes alone can start today, but he who travels with another must wait until that other is ready."
Those words stayed with Alireza. They were so familiar. They sounded just like lines from the beloved Iranian poets his grandfather constantly recited to him. And so his journey began. First, he had to improve his English.
I didn't have easy access to sources for studying English. For a long time, I studied English through old newspapers and magazines and whatever film I could find. I just was serious and persistent until the day I found access to the internet, and it was a huge help.
A huge help, not just for learning English.
When Ali joined the group, it wasn't very easy for him because internet access was very limited.
That's Kirk McElhern. Back in 1996, he created an internet group that let Thoreau enthusiasts connect and exchange ideas. Little did McElhern know then that about a decade later, the listserv would change the life of a man in Iran.
He started out just asking some simple questions, and then at some point he explained that he was going to translate it into Farsi, which just sounded like such a wonderful idea. And he would ask us questions, what does this mean? And we would try and help him figure out what certain things meant. And, you know, this is language from the middle of the 19th century, which even for modern Americans isn't always easy.
Over the years, the group became a gateway for Alireza Takhtare to get to know Thoreau scholars in the U.S. and around the world. And gradually, it became more than Thoreau and translation of a book. It became a way to get to know the people on the other side of the computer screen. It turned into a cultural exchange. Here's Kirk McElhern again.
I know very little about Iran. I did have a very good friend when I was a teenager who was from Iran, but other than pistachios, I didn't know much about the country.
My interest in Iran and Iranian people has been completely opened up.
That's Jeffrey Kramer, a Thoreau scholar who edited the version of Walden that Alireza ended up translating.
He's gotten to know my family, my children, my mother-in-law. We have Skyped with him, with his family, with his daughters, his wife.
Finally, the virtual became reality when earlier this month Alireza visited the U.S. Those friends he'd made over the internet helped him get a visa and even chipped in to cover his travel expenses. So after years of imagining Thoreau's world, Alireza was able to see, touch, smell, and feel it for himself. Next, Alireza plans to translate Thoreau's other work into Farsi, and after that, he focused on Emily Dickinson. He hopes that by making those works available in his native language, he'll create a bridge that connects people from two very different and often misunderstood worlds.
It's not just literature, it's the connection that this literary work reflects to my people. It shows that friendship is possible.
For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Still to come, in France, it's the silly season, and we're going to indulge our silly side because Gisele Bündchen on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you're into the luge or Nordic skiing or short track speed skating, today's the day you can start those travel plans to go to the 2022 Games. Your airline ticket will be sending you to the Far East. The International Olympic Committee has voted, and here is IOC President Thomas Bach announcing the results.
The International Olympic Committee has the honor to announce the host city of the Olympic Winter Games 2022. Beijing.
And the crowd goes wild. The band plays on. So Beijing has another Olympics, this time the Winter Games. It beat out Almaty, Kazakhstan, and, just Kazakhstan. That's because Stockholm, Sweden, Krakow, Poland, and Oslo, Norway all did like us here in Boston. They pulled out of the bidding. Anders K. Christensen is a sports journalist with VG. That's a Norwegian newspaper, and he joins us from Oslo. So I guess congratulations are not in order. Why did Oslo back out of its Olympic bid last fall?
Well, you know, I've followed the discussions in Boston, and I see some similarities. It's basically people being concerned about how much money this is. Norway has traditionally been very skeptical towards IOC as a movement, I would say. It's been like that for many years. So yep. That made it impossible for the Norwegian government to vote yes.
Where has that skepticism come from in Norway?
Well, if you go back to Lillehammer in 1994, it was already there before the games when Juan Antonio Samarang was head of office in the IOC. It was huge discussions in Norway, and he was actually saying he planned not to go at some point. So it's been there for many years, and people are skeptical about sport politicians driving around in limousines. That's not very Norwegian.
So not only are, you know, IOC officials driving around in limousines, but then you dig into the 7,000-page document provided by the IOC for Oslo's bid, and you found some pretty surprising things in the list of what Norway would have to provide for the games if they got the games. What did you find?
Yeah, well, this was one of the good things that I think the Norwegian bid committee pressed forward. They made the IOC make this public, and in the technical manuals there were things saying that they would like to meet the king, they would like to have the temperature at the offices at 21 or 22 degrees Celsius. I don't remember it exactly. They were to be provided with a certain telephone with a Norwegian number. They were having free beers, free alcohol on their venues for the IOC. So there are lots of these things that the IOC later on said was just not demands. They said it was something they recommended. So that was a bit of the argument there, but at least that's what the technical manual said. And that this was, of course, coming at the crucial stage in the Norwegian bid. Just hours later, we published that story. The Norwegian coalition government said no.
Yeah, there were a couple of others that you didn't mention that are just – it's like reading the kind of rider sheet for some rock stars, like having fruit and cakes of the season in IOC members' rooms, having mini bars stocked with Coca-Cola. I mean, when you first saw this document, how did you react?
You know, this is the IOC. We know what we're talking about. But, you know, to the general audience, to the public, this was huge. This was big news. And it made it very, very difficult to say yes for a coalition government already fighting against a majority of the people saying no.
Anders K. Christensen is a sports journalist in Oslo with the newspaper VG. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
A couple of days ago, we told you about the only time World War I actually reached American shores, back in 1918 when a German U-boat fired on a tugboat off the coast of Massachusetts. Some of the German artillery missed the target and landed on Cape Cod instead. That was not the only time wartime munitions wound up on New England beaches. It happened a lot, especially as part of American military exercises through the years. And some of those munitions are still being found today. My WGBH colleague here in Boston, Edgar B. Herwick III, has that story.
Right around this time last year, a small crowd gathered on a Cape Cod beach to watch from a distance as the Massachusetts State Bomb Squad detonated a 14-inch projectile found buried in the sand.
Here we go.
The unexploded ordnance, or UXO, was still live, despite the fact that it was some 70 years old. Sergeant William Qualls, who heads the Massachusetts State Bomb Squad, explains that during World War II, the military was quite active on the Cape and the surrounding islands.
We had a number of, I guess you could call them test ranges, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, as well as some outlying islands.
There were large-scale naval exercises on the coast, shooting ranges on the islands, even a mock German village was built on Cape Cod to prepare soldiers for urban warfare. As you might imagine, the area was crawling with munitions. As it turns out, it still is.
it would be beyond me to speculate on that, but it's common knowledge that there were large amounts of ordnance dumped off into the waters, into the deep seas.
And here's Dave Foster, spokesperson for the United States Army.
Chemical warfare munitions sea disposals occurred between 1919 and 1970, when it was both an authorized method of disposal and remained an accepted practice.
Perhaps the biggest haul came after World War II, when tens, maybe even hundreds of thousands of tons of surplus artillery and munitions were dumped into the waters off the Atlantic coast.
Artillery shells,
37-millimeter projectiles, 75-millimeter projectiles,
bombs,
Mark 23, some drop munitions,
mines, grenades,
a couple of pyrophoric rounds.
In short, a whole lot of nasty stuff. And some seven decades later, Qual says it's still finding its way back to shore.
If you average out our numbers, we respond to about 15 military calls or military item requests per month.
A majority of those are actually house calls. Someone's cleaning out their parents or their grandparents' home and finds a grenade or a mortar shell in the basement. Still, beach calls happen all the time.
90% of the items that wash up on our shores or that are discovered in sand dunes or beach areas are from World War II era.
The majority of these UXOs proved to be inert, but not all of them. And Qualls and his 12-person team know exactly how to deal with most of them. Still, there is the occasional surprise, usually found by fishermen further out in the water.
A torpedo brought into Provincetown port. We had a depth charge brought into Gloucester. We had the mustard munitions brought into New Bedford. Those are the more notable ones.
There's a reason for this. The more dangerous and noxious weapons were dumped further out at greater depths. And Army spokesperson Dave Foster says that in recent years, they're increasingly being dredged up.
The fishing industry is now bringing them up with their catch. Because the technology, the advanced technology, allows them to go further out, to go deeper.
Foster says the Army works closely with the fishing industry to put safety measures and procedures in place. But, of course, Massachusetts has a vast coastline. And that's why Sergeant Qual stresses that if you find something curious on the beach, whatever you do, don't touch it.
Treat it with the utmost respect. Treat it as live until proven otherwise by the professionals. Mark it, make notice of the location, and then contact local authorities immediately.
Thankfully, injuries are rare. Still, Qual stresses that even the smallest movement can cause a UXO to do harm. After all, that's exactly what they were designed to do. For The World, I'm Edgar B. Herwick III.
Coming up, a British doctor fighting the good fight in Yemen on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Saudi airstrikes in Yemen continue, and Yemenis are paying a heavy price.
They have health needs, they have injuries that need treating, but if they have to stay inside because they're so afraid, then there's not very much we can do to help them.
A British doctor working in Yemen. Her story's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like networking, nutrition, and ninja training. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Did you know that U.S. food aid is on its way to Yemen? Yep, more than 58,000 tons of American wheat to help feed Yemenis displaced by the country's civil war. Of course, turning that wheat into flour and then into bread and then getting it to those who need it is going to be a huge challenge. There's no let up in Yemen's war. It's a complicated conflict which started with Houthi rebels ousting the country's president and continues now with a Saudi Arabian airstrike campaign against the Houthis. Few Western journalists have been able to get into Yemen to report from there. It's just too dangerous. Plus, the Saudis are not allowing journalists into the country. But that did not deter American reporter Matthew Akins. He hired a smuggler to take him to Yemen by powerboat. They cross the sea at night from Djibouti in East Africa. I asked him why he thinks the Saudis are trying to keep reporters out.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. They've been accused by the UN, by Human Rights Watch, and by Amnesty International of violating the laws of war, of committing war crimes by indiscriminately bombing civilians in an attempt to displace these rebels. And while, of course, the rebels have also committed human rights abuses, the fact that there's not really a lot of international pressure on Saudi Arabia and it's being backed by the U.S., I think has allowed them a much freer hand in pursuing this devastating air campaign.
All right. So tell us what you saw. You get to Yemen, then you travel inland by road through the capital up to Sada province, and that's the home base for the Houthi rebels. What kind of conditions did you see there?
Well, this whole border province had been declared a military target by Saudi Arabia, sort of like the free fire zones that the U.S. used to do in Vietnam. And the whole area is absolutely devastated. The road that we went in on was being targeted by coalition jets. There was charred vehicles, dead goats along the way. And then the city, Sada city in the north, is just bombed into rubble. They've hit schools, houses, government buildings, markets, restaurants, basically targeting anything that moves, in the words of one person there.
Yeah, anything that moves them. You said dead goats. What was that all about?
They're basically trying to strangle the border areas, just like they're blockading the entire country, which the UN and other humanitarian groups are calling collective punishment against the Yemeni people. So too are they basically trying to cut off this one province by road. So in this case, a truck full of goats had been hit by a jet.
Wow. So these Saudi bombing runs have forced a lot of people into homelessness. And you spoke with a French doctor who was pretty upset about the lack of humanitarian response and the number of internally displaced people. Is that true? Isn't Red Cross there? Is there any United Nations presence?
Well, the response has really been slow. There's over a million Yemenis who've been displaced from their homes. The UN has warned that 6 million are on the brink of starvation, that a famine is right around the corner. But because of the blockade and the evacuation of internationals at the beginning of conflict, the UN and other international humanitarian agencies have really been slow to respond. So we saw refugees who were camped out in the open. They weren't being given food or even water. Now, what's interesting is that in the beginning of war, when the UN made an appeal for emergency humanitarian aid for Yemen, $274 million, Saudi Arabia pledged the whole amount that same day. And yet, you know, months later, none of it has actually been delivered.
Are you basically saying that because the Saudis said they would pay for all the aid that nobody else came forward?
Yeah, exactly. So there's two theories. One is that this is actually deliberate. And the second is that just the Saudis didn't really have experience and they pledged the money and then realized later on that these kinds of money can't have strings attached to it. Otherwise, the UN won't accept it. You know, and the Saudis maybe didn't want this aid going into certain areas controlled by their rivals.
You were in Yemen long enough, Matthew, to talk with a lot of Yemenis. What's on their minds as this war just goes on?
They want to know what their future will be. You know, I think they feel like things are spiraling out of control, that the fate of their country is now up to these warring militias and regional proxy wars. And of course, what's on everyone's mind, I think, is the fate of other wars that sort of began with the uprisings of the Arab Spring in Libya, in Syria. You also have the conflict in Iraq, which is, of course, related to the U.S. invasion of the region. And just incredible suffering that is part of the reason why we're having this massive migration crisis and refugee crisis today. So if you look at those examples in Libya, Iraq, and Syria, it's hard not to feel very pessimistic about Yemen's future, that this could get just as bad as those places, and the world will just stand by helplessly or cynically.
Matthew Akins wrote about his extraordinary journey into Yemen in this week's edition of Rolling Stone. Matthew, thanks very much for telling us about this.
It's my pleasure.
Natalie Roberts is a British doctor who is not just standing by. For the past few months, she's been in Yemen, working with Doctors Without Borders to provide emergency medical aid. She's also been recording her experiences on her mobile phone. I want you to hear some of that, starting with a recording of Roberts in a car on her way to a rural clinic.
The roads are targeted. Cars are often hit, and as I'm driving along the road now, I can see a truck that was bombed a few hours ago. It's still burning. It was carrying apples and wheat, so the sacks of wheat are on fire. Every single bridge on the road is being bombed out. It's just an intimidating experience to drive up and down this road and be aware that any minute an aeroplane could be coming. We have a flag on the roof, but it doesn't feel like it gives me a huge amount of protection when you drive past scenes like this. I'm in the emergency room of a health centre that we've been supporting in the mountains of North Yemen. On all the villages and towns nearby, sustained airstrikes most days. There's a six-year-old boy here with a piece of shrapnel in his eye that he sustained this morning. It means he's lost his eye. He's being very brave. He's lying on his bed, still covered in blood, unfortunately. His mother's talking to him.
They've already had 3 trauma cases so far this morning, and it's 11:30 in the morning.
Natalie Roberts joins me now from Yemen in the city of Hamir. Really extraordinary to hear some of the experiences you're living through. What happened to that boy who lost his eye?
Yeah, I mean, he was really, what was really surprising about the boy was he was so quiet and so brave. He was just kind of lying there and obviously a big shock to him, but just really, really tolerating it incredibly well, which was a surprising sight to see.
Natalie, I know you've worked in conflict zones before, but what's different about what's happening in Yemen? What's most surprising or concerning about the situation there?
What's really surprising to me here and concerning is that I've never seen this few people on the ground. There's very little aid on the ground for people. In Syria, I know that at the time when I was there, it was counted as the most dangerous conflict in the world. But Yemen, I just haven't really met anybody, and I've been moving around the whole area. So that's the most surprising thing to me, is given the scale of damage and destruction and what's happening to people, how little help is coming through.
You've been encountering a lot of terrible stories of people during wartime, and I imagine all these personal tragedies stick with you. But I gather one case in particular was really haunting. Can you tell us about meeting a little girl in northern Yemen in the city of Sada?
Yeah, actually, it was a town outside Sada, so it was in the mountains outside Sada. What happened was this little girl was living in a cave with her family and 3 other families. But unfortunately, there was an airstrike on the cave, so a missile entered the cave mouth, collapsing the cave. I first saw her in the health facility. She'd been brought in by a man, and she had a really quite minor wound, small injury. So I was quite surprised they'd bother to bring her to the hospital. But then it was explained to me that the cave had collapsed and she was the only survivor. She was maybe about 5 or 6 years old. So she'd lost her entire family. They were all dead. What really concerned me was the fact that she had nobody left.
Wow.
It really wasn't very clear to me who's going to be looking after her in the future.
Yeah, so, I mean, without her family, can you imagine what her life is going to be like now?
I think it would be very hard for her. That village that she lives in is bombed pretty much every day. You know, I think her situation is quite bleak. She won't be able to go to school. I don't really know, in the long run whether she'll survive, because that town is just so incredibly dangerous.
Yeah. What is the biggest need that people in Yemen have right now?
I mean, I think the number one priority for people is protection. Obviously, they have huge needs. They have health needs. They have, injuries that need treating. But the main priority for me is to try and get to some point where civilians are protected. But if they have to stay inside because they're so afraid, then there's not very much we can do to help them.
Natalie Roberts is a British doctor working with Doctors Without Borders in Yemen. Natalie, thank you very much for speaking with us, and thank you for doing your own documentation of this war.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Summer news stories. European media know this is the silly season when stories with some questionable news value rise to the top. So we're going to indulge our silly season side for a moment. You've all heard about quarterback Tom Brady once again claiming this week he had nothing to do with deflated footballs. But now Brady's wife, Brazilian supermodel Gisele Bündchen, has her own controversy to manage. Bündchen was supposedly photographed recently visiting a plastic surgeon in Paris. That's not the controversial part, though. For a supermodel, it ought to raise some questions. The really controversial part is that she allegedly tried to go incognito, covered head to toe in a burqa, actually head to ankle. The pictures show the woman's open-toed sandals, which, as any burqa-wearing woman knows, totally defeats the point. Bündchen has not confirmed she was the one in the photos, but the images have sparked outrage in France and beyond. French journalist Anne-Elisabeth Moutet is with me to dish a bit. But seriously, Anne-Elisabeth, what on earth was she thinking?
I suppose she was thinking that she didn't want people to know about her going to have a little bit of nip and tuck. She knew that rich women went to such clinics, and some of these rich women were from the Gulf, and therefore wearing a burqa sounded, good to her. And she didn't pause to think that burqas are immensely noticeable in France because they are illegal.
Yeah, that's a huge problem, too. How have the French reacted to this story?
You know, it's a wonderful story. And as they say in Hollywood, it's got legs. But the truth is that the French fighter...
Hidden legs.
If you can say this with open-toed sandals and a burqa. But to be honest, you know, all the papers took it, but they were having a bit of a laugh about it more than anything else. The French are not scandalized. They think it's amusing.
Is anyone saying that in the context of tension in Muslim communities and non-Muslim communities, that this is kind of outrageous?
To be honest, you have one or two activists who are well-known Islamists, and they have issued statements saying that this is a holy garment and she was defiling the holy garment. But the burqa is not at all indigenous to France. The problem in France is about a couple of thousand women, more than half of whom are recent converts to Wahhabism. It's something that has been seized by these people to say, you can't make that case. But to most French Muslims, where the headscarf could be an issue, the burqa isn't really.
Well, as you say, France banned burqas in 2010. Could there be any legal repercussions for Gisele Bündchen?
One of the nice things about the French judicial system, it's different from the American judicial system in which, you know, it's very binary in America. You're right or you're wrong, which is morally admirable. The French understand grey nuances, and they understand that the top model who's swathing herself in something to go into a cosmetic surgery clinic is probably not trying to flout French law. She's just trying to get rid of paparazzi, and it didn't work anyway.
The fact that this happened during the month of Ramadan, has there been any reaction from the Muslim community?
That was not terribly tactful, was it? I haven't seen anything so big that it made the news. The other thing is that she is not as famous in France as she is in other countries. We know about Kate Moss, we know about others. She's not the one that you think immediately when you think supermodel. It's a lovely story and people think this is fun. But there has been a bit of talk about plastic surgery as well, because you're supposed to still sort of pretend that there's no such thing as plastic surgery. If you take somebody like Gisele Bündchen, who I think is 36, we are talking about her capital. She is making literally millions out of looking seriously good. That she wants to maintain her capital, it seems like a perfectly sensible and normal thing to do. So there's a bit of manufactured outrage on this one.
Apparently, there is some question as to whether it was Gisele Bündchen in that burqa. Have you heard any confirmation?
I've heard. I mean, there is a wonderful series of pictures in that trove of journalistic accuracy, the Daily Mail of London, who have all the pictures because they pay the most to the paparazzi. And they compared the hands of Gisele arriving in Paris in a short skirt and the usual what you'd expect from her, and the hands of the woman grasping the edge of the burqa. And they were remarkably similar.
All right. Until any denial, we'll go with the accuracy of the Daily Mail's photographs.
Absolutely.
Anne-Elisabeth Moutet in Paris, thank you.
Thank you.
Three little words over time, overheard and overused.
Hey, it's almost the weekend. How about some Britpop to grease the skids?
No, sweet nothing could ever be turned into something new.
It's the new release from English singer Leon LaHavas. A quick dose now from her CD Blood, which is out today.
So I could spend it all on you. On you. Oh, all I need is to see you smile. I've forgotten how to be blue. Blue. I know what I've got and I know where we're going. You don't need to show it. I already know it all. It's what you don't do. It's what you don't say.
It's what you don't do.
Not enough to keep you satisfied? Don't worry, we got you covered. More from Leon LaHavas in just a few minutes, right here on The World.
the World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Bad news for journalists in Latin America. There's been an increase in the number of violent attacks against reporters throughout the region, and a recent report by the watchdog group Freedom House points out that government harassment of reporters is also up in many Latin American countries. One country in particular tops the list as one of the most dangerous places on earth for journalists today, and that would be Mexico. All of this was discussed at a congressional hearing this week in Washington. It was chaired by Representative Jeff Duncan from South Carolina. Here's what he had to say on Mexico.
When it comes to violence against the media, Mexico exists as one of the most dangerous countries for media, with journalists often receiving extortion and kidnapping threats from government officials, criminal groups, and other transnational gangs. In fact, Mexico accounts for more than a third of all the killing of media workers and journalists in the hemisphere since 2009.
Now, one of those who testified at the meeting was someone we've had on The World before, Alfredo Corchado, Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News.
I live in, work in, call home, a country where, in recent months, every 26 hours, a reporter is attacked, most of them by either the government or criminal gangs. Too many journalists in my homeland of Mexico have paid the ultimate price. This afternoon, I hope to honor their memory.
The Dallas Morning News, Alfredo Corchado, they're testifying this week on Capitol Hill. You said at that hearing that you wanted to honor the memory of the journalists who died. Why did you go to Capitol Hill and provide this testimony?
It's personal and it's professional. I mean, personal. I was born in Mexico. I live in Mexico. I spent half my life in Mexico. I have many, many colleagues who have been harassed, some who have been threatened, some who have been killed. And so it's personal. I mean, it's also affected me on a very personal level. And it's professional because, I mean, that's what we do as journalists. We try to tell the truth. And oftentimes, you know, you have an opportunity from a U.S. Congress to speak to them. I mean, you're hesitant because as a journalist, you're not used to doing such things. But I also think it's important to try to break the silence.
How much of the violence that we're hearing about is tied to drug trafficking and the cartels wanting to keep reporters from looking too closely at what they're doing?
Much of it. But I think the more troubling question is what is the collusion like between drug traffickers and the government? And that's something that it's become much, much more apparent that you can't really distinguish one from the other. The harassment, the attacks, the killings. It's not just tied to drug traffickers, but the government officials. And oftentimes you don't know which is which. I mean, it's not a black or white situation.
Yeah. So tell me more then about government corruption. How bad is that situation in Mexico?
I mean, some of the worst states are Oaxaca, Veracruz, places like Michoacan. And oftentimes you see, you know, it's the government who are trying to keep reporters from reporting certain stories. You have the government oftentimes coming out and saying, well, you know, so-and-so was involved in this or was involved in that. When they're clearly trying to protect themselves. They're trying to cover up for themselves and cover up their collusion with the drug traffickers. It's easy money, and it changes hands on both sides. It's important to note, Marco, that in spite of all the dangers, in spite of all the risks, you still have a lot of very brave journalists trying to do investigative work, trying to hold the powerful accountable. And so it's an interesting situation where you have more and more attacks, but at the same time, you have more and more journalists who are saying, no, we're not going to be silenced. We're going to fight back.
Have you ever been the target of threats or harassment?
Yes. I mean, that's why I say it's very personal. I mean, in 2007, I received a call from a U.S., trusted U.S. source who said there is a pending attack in the 24 hours that's coming from the CETAS, and it's against an American journalist. We think it's you. It turned me into a mess. I mean, I ended up leaving Mexico for a while. And I think that was the waking moment where you realize I'm an American journalist. And maybe that's why to this day I've had more protection. It's something that's difficult to grapple with because I am born in Mexico. I consider myself Mexican. And yet I feel I have that much more protection because I want to believe that if something was to happen to me, someone in the United States would say something and that I would not be just another faceless victim. That's the problem in Mexico. There's so much impunity. Over 90% of the cases remain unsolved, or people don't even investigate. I mean, they kill a journalist because they can't, and they can get away with it.
And the advantage for the government of colluding with the drug cartels, is it just about money?
It's certainly about money. It's about their own complicity. It's about, you know, how the government works. I mean, oftentimes people will say in Mexico, corruption is really its own institution. I mean, it's there. It's that powerful. permeates all sectors of society.
And yet, despite all the dangers, you keep reporting from Mexico. Why do you do it?
I keep reporting in Mexico because I love my profession. I think as a foreign correspondent, there's a responsibility to try to go after the truth. You know, as corny as that may sound, I mean, that's really, I think, what inspires many of us to go into the field and many of us to tell these stories, that you're trying to shine light. You're trying to hold the powerful accountable, and you're trying to inform a society. I mean, sadly, there are many places in Mexico today, many regions that are known as zonas de silencios, zones of silence, where people, reporters say nothing, know nothing, and that doesn't help democracy. I mean, when you have an uninformed society that's focused a lot more on social media, you know, and oftentimes social media is also controlled by drug traffickers, there is that responsibility that if you can, to continue reporting, to try to continue telling these stories.
Alfredo Corchado, Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, thank you very much. And I know you're careful, but please stay safe.
My pleasure, Marco. Un abrazo.
Okay, back to that bigger dose of Britpop I promised you from singer Leon LaJavis. A slower number now that sounds crazy like Dusty Springfield.
Oh, man, let me wipe your eyes.
We know British artists have skills when it comes to reworking American sounds and styles, whether it's jazz or soul or the blues. Leon LaJavis put hers on display with her critically acclaimed 2012 debut, Is Your Love Big Enough? And then she went to Jamaica to experience her mother's roots, met a bunch of long-lost relatives, and connected with a place she never knew.
All these memories, too much to lose. No one ever leaves you.
Leon says all the songs on her new album, Blood, out today, are about where you come from. So I want to share with you this sweet one called Good Goodbye. We're going to leave it there today and wish you goodbye. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. The World comes to you from right here in the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you Monday.
You'd say this is all there. Every time you blink, you miss another piece of this wondrous world. All I'd ask is why do you leave so soon? Everybody seems to. I just want you. No one ever leaves you. Everybody.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.